TJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Wake up, sleepyheads. This is TJSF 90.1 FM.
And you're tuning in to Slumber Party.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, community radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the stolen ancestral territory of the Kwakwutlam, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh.
Listen online at cjsf.ca or on our radio app, which you can download from the app or Google Store, depending on your device. Keep up to date on our social media at linktree.com/cjsfradio and learn more by visiting our website, cjsf.ca. Got a request? Text or call us at 778-782-CJSF, which is 2573. Welcome again. I am DJ Star.
And I'm DJ Coco. Welcome to Slumber Party. We are here every Tuesday from 6 to 7. So we've got a pretty big topic for today, which we're going to get into very shortly.
We've been researching.
We've had an intense research session about this, and we are going to try to condense it as much as we can and bring up the best points we can. But stay tuned for that. But we will play one song before we do that, because we have a Twizzler to share that we need to eat first.
Mm-hmm.
Outside the room, sorry, not in the studio.
No, we would never.
No, never. But what's this first song?
The first song is White Fur. It's by Cherry Pick from their new EP. I don't know how to say this because it's just a colon and a three, but, you know, it makes a little face.
Oh, it's
cute.
Like that, like, ooh face. I don't want to say ooh, but
kind of. But they're a local Vancouver band. Go check them out. And, yeah, if you like it.
Enjoy.
Thank you. doesn't love music? Join the weekly discussion at the CJSF Record Club with other music aficionados, checking out new releases and forgotten classics, exploring and learning about genres and loving music. Every Thursday at CJSF Burnaby from 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. Listen, learn, and share.
Welcome back. Welcome back. The song that you just heard was Deny by La Securité. And yeah, we only played two songs because we have quite the hefty topic coming up.
Yes. And you are tuning in to CJSF 9.1 FM. Sorry about that.
Television.
And this is Slumber Party. So we'll be getting into quite a heavier topic. Where we're going to be talking about, which is inspired by the recent switch to, as you may have seen or heard about it, this era of thinness or thinspo. And it seems very drastic now of how the ideals have changed for female beauty or for beauty standards and for weights. But this has been a trend over history, which we'd like to get into, and also all the implications with all these weight changes that have been happening. So I think DJ Star will set the stage, though.
Yeah, so I think, firstly, we did mention this idea of thinspo and thinness on our last episode, and I think that intrigued both of us because it has been quite noticeable, the shift in how much a woman should weigh, kind of, in society, because a lot of it has been influenced by Ozempic. and how that's been popularized through a lot of major celebrities either going on Ozempic or becoming extremely thin. And some of them we could mention are Ariana Grande, Meghan Trainor, Demi Moore, apparently Serena Williams as mm-hmm. well, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, so I think that one's quite sad because she's always been known as this, you know, powerful tennis player, and now she's also spoken up about using Ozempic, which she says is just for a healthy lifestyle and everything. But there are, I think, a lot of conflicting opinions about the use of Ozempic for losing weight and living a healthy lifestyle, which, again, is a whole nother conversation. But she is one example as well.
Yeah, and I've personally seen, other than in Hollywood, I've seen a lot of videos online pushing this thinness goal, and even specific workouts designed to only pursue thinness and not gain any muscle or any other additives for your body, like just reducing it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of known as a recession body, the term has been coined, which is kind of connected to part of our political climate, at least. And eating disorders have been on the rise for quite a while. I think they've probably existed for a long time, even before this study, but the worldwide prevalence has doubled from 3.4 to 7.8 from 2000 to 2018, and I think it's just continuing from there.
And to mention with the eating disorders as well is that it is a more internally based disorder, and internally based disorders primarily have women who have been affected. So this eating disorder rise is majority and dominated by women with eating disorders, even though there are men with them as well.
Yeah, and like this has gone on for so long, and as well hand in hand with other kind of beauty ideals, and it is kind of a mechanism to oppress women and also benefit from this oppression, because why would you oppress a certain group of people if you couldn't benefit from it? And Naomi Wolf, she's this feminist theorist, and she wrote the book The Beauty Myth: How Images of Beauty Are Used Against Women. And she basically has the idea that diet culture is a tool to divert women's attention away from achieving political and social power, because they are so focused on maintaining a certain expectation of themselves through starving themselves or spending a lot of time and energy into attaining this impossible standard.
Oh, definitely. I think this one, I feel like even in my own life, like if you see also growing up, like you've been told by others and family members and the media, you know, focus on your looks and, you know, stay in shape kind of things, and don't get too chubby, don't get too skinny, et cetera, et cetera. So trying to always obtain, for this specific example of weight, of always constantly thinking on your mind, like, oh, we got to watch what I'm eating. I've got to watch how much exercise I'm doing. And so that takes away a lot of mental energy to do things like, you know, actually studying and, or, you know, thinking about things that are happening in the world and these injustices that are happening, for example. Or it's just keeping you very mentally tired, just constantly thinking about this.
Yeah, and even on the more extreme side is that if you are severely underweight because of an eating disorder, your cognitive abilities are way lower. Your body, just your ability to function overall, is severely compromised by that. And yeah, like it kind of just continues to hurt women while, I guess, perpetuating this idea that that is necessary for women to be valued in society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we do it.
And as well, this whole idea of this oppression for women to, you know, constantly think about their appearance, specifically their weight and how their body looks, is something that they can capitalize on, and they can make money if we don't resist this.
Yeah. I just wanted to put a little quote in here too, because I think it's a good one, and it is from Naomi Wolf, but she says, "A culture fixated on female thinness is not an obsession about female beauty, but an obsession about female obedience." And that is a lot that has to do with also just like the changing kind of beauty standards. Yeah, like it looks like it is about beauty, but how could it be about beauty if it's like constantly changing and it's never enough? Like, there's no such thing as like a perfect person, I guess, in the idea of the cosmetics industry or plastic surgery industry. Like, it is just a way to make people submit and spend more money and do all these other things to kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess just compromise themselves to do other more effective or productive things with their lives, or mm-hmm. even resist the system at all.
Definitely. And I feel like this quote can also be more represented by us going into a more historical analysis over the years, as I'm not sure if we all know, but for female beauty, our female body standards have been changing all the time over the past century, few centuries, decades even.
It goes really far back.
Yeah, and we can go far back into, you know, the ancient societies as well. And just overall, it feels like there has never been one beauty standard at any point in time that has been, you know, dominant across the entire world at the exact same time. And the major idea, I think, that can be seen is that there's a lot of, even though there's a bunch of nuances in between, but this concept of a woman being very slender and thin versus a woman being very curvy and having, you know, very womanly hips, for example. And that's a bit confusing because it's like, you know, what should a woman look like? Which is a question that can never be answered.
Because the answer is that there is no one way, right?
Yeah.
Naturally, just even if we think about biologically, if we're trying to get essentialist about it, that there is not really any one way that a woman looks or acts. So, yeah.
Exactly. Like, everyone has their own preferences, and thank gosh we all have our own preferences, because that's how we are able to reproduce if we get through to the evolutionary side of this. Because
thank God for that.
Thank God, like, we like all types of women. Thank God we all like all types of men on all types of body types, because then only a certain... Okay, I can get way too biological about the evolution side of this, but just overall, it's good that, you know, in reality and in realistic situations, that everyone enjoys a certain body type, to each their own. But we're saying that with how people are able to capitalize on it, and with different societies, they have their own ideas of what someone should look like, which can influence the people in that society or and the ideas of it. So for things like, you know, ancient Egypt, they really preferred slender, thinner women versus ancient Greece, who they preferred a very plump and curvy woman. But ancient Greece, it's a little...
They hated women as well.
They also hated women. They thought they were subpar to men, so mm-hmm. there's that as well. But anyways, there's the Han Dynasty, so they preferred very slim and also pale women. Italian Renaissance, they preferred very plump, curvy hips. And then medieval, there was also very full, you know, plump, robust physique. And so as you can see, like, every society and every different time, and they're all looking for different things of what they want a woman to look like.
And it's all socially constructed, in my opinion, at least,
yeah.
like, these standards for women, and also, you know, cutting off women from, like, oh, you're not the ideal woman. And that goes for, like, that extends even far beyond people who are, like, born as women, I feel like, too. Like, there's always just this, like, very strict binary of what a woman should look like and what a man should look like. And there's no room in between.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that kind of in the trends as well, of, like, okay, it's either this or all this.
Yeah.
And you can't, there's not a lot of movement unless it's between each decade.
Mm-hmm. I think as well with this, you know, maybe overall trend, which is still hard to categorize, but it's this idea that, as you can see in some of the societies, like, these are in ancient times, for example, that these were in a different era of how humans lived. Same with today as well, which we'll get into, but I think what our main idea is that people, essentially, that we want what the majority can't have, thus we need to work for it. And this means that, you know, for example, if we go back to the medieval era, they really admired you know, these very full and robust physiques. And it was because that potentially at that time, that it was a time where not a lot of people had food. And so only the rich had a lot of food. So if you were, you know, full and robust, and it meant that you ate good, which meant you were rich, and thus you were seen as the ideal at that time.
Yeah, and vice versa, if wealth becomes a lot more widespread, then thinness often prevails as a beauty standard as well. And a lot of these kind of standards, of course, because only the minority can achieve these standards a lot of the time, that they are imposed by, you know, the ruling class, the bourgeoisie, they're the ones who kind of do have much more control and power and influence in our society than the majority. So they are the ones who are able to sell these narratives to us, and especially they're the ones who are able to achieve those very narratives that they're selling.
Exactly. And that's like today. So that's what we kind of base this conversation off, is how right now we are wanting these super thin ideals, which in a time where we have more food than in, I think, many points of human life, that we're able to farm and we're able to produce food at large quantities, and especially with the amount of preservatives and fast food and junk food, that it's easier to gain weight than ever. So the obesity crisis, for example. So then being something that the majority of people couldn't be, so such as being super thin, became more idolized.
Yeah, and it is. This gets to be a really complex topic, because who's to say if, like, we are in a society where we can access a lot of things, but at the same time, inflation is on the rise. There is a lot of different types of scarcity on the rise, too. So it's like, why is thinness still an ideal when we are somewhat in a time of scarcity? And there is an alternative theory, and it is slightly competing, but I feel like we can kind of make these theories work together in some way, because this guy named Michael Foucault, he has this idea of biopower, where I think it is pretty accurate that a lot of different elements of society, or like media or standards, are kind of mirroring what values society currently holds. And he uses this idea of like, oh, the body is a mirror of the values that society wants us to have during that time and place. So the idea with scarcity is that the body needs the least, like the thinnest bodies need the absolute least to function. So they don't consume as much. They're about efficiency and self-control. And this is also putting all of the responsibility onto the individual as well, which is, you know, like a very important value in capitalism. And this happens on women's bodies specifically because of the kind of like the stuff that we've mentioned before of how historically they have been targeted, and that is a site of social control. So like abortion laws, any kind of changing social expectations are also part of that. So I just think that's also kind of like, yeah, it is a reaction to what, you know, the majority can't have, but it's also kind of a mirror of what society wants us to have as well, that we can't actually have sometimes. So yeah.
Interesting. I guess, yeah, we can use some examples in history then.
Oh, we have some examples, don't we? We have a timeline, actually.
We've got our timeline to help that point. So we've collected a little timeline to share here, which we'll start from the 1920s with...
So 100 years ago, pretty much.
Yeah, actually, wow, 100 years ago. That are how specifically female... body ideals have changed over the decades. So started off with, you know, 1920s, we've got the roaring 20s. We are just finishing World War I, and we've got this flapper ideal. So it's this girl who's, you know, very skinny, small chested, very tomboyish look to her. I think she's also got slightly shorter skirts, but still pretty modest overall.
But not for the era.
Not for the era. They thought it was completely promiscuous at the time. Mm-hmm. The traditional conservative older generations were like, what are these young women wearing?
Yeah, and this was just associated with all different types of rebellion against, especially against Victorian femininity, but also against like larger society's expectations for women should be staying in the house and, you know, taking care of their households rather than going out and having fun in public spaces, which is kind of what flappers were known for. So that was a very dramatic shift from the previous centuries into this, yeah, more like rebellious idea of what a woman could be in the future. So, yeah, mm-hmm. There's other political, I guess, changes too.
And it's also argued that the 20s were actually at a time could have been better for women, such as compared to the 1950s. There were these ideas that, for example, after World War One, when, you know, a lot of, like, we finished the First World War was finished, and of course there was so many men killed and just humans in general who were killed, and so after the war, this inspired a lot of young people and young women to, quote unquote, spend their youth enjoying life and freedom rather than staying at home and waiting for a man to marry them.
Yep.
So at this point, you know, they wanted to spend their lives and, you know, be more free. This was also about the time, the 1920s, when women could now vote. You know, there were more opportunities in the workplace. And even though that they were still, there's still a large majority that were doing the household chores and taking care of the kids, not having a job, there were now increasingly more and more women who were wanting to go work. And as well, even in the household, you know, we're at a time where we've had technology, so we have new appliances to be able to reduce the household chores. You know, there's contraception now, so now we have less kids at this time. So that's just the setting of the 1920s.
And there was a brief shift back in the 1930s to this glamorous aesthetic, because that was also during the Great Depression, where I guess a lot of people did not have the money or the time or the energy to care about or to even pursue, I guess, like this idea of glamour and makeup and, like, you know, just expensive clothing. And then that's contrasted again by a return to the 1940s, where it's back to kind of strength and almost more like masculine ideals.
Yeah, this is when the Second World War was, you know, in play in the 1940s, as the Second World War ended in 1945. So, you know, women were, yeah, in the factories, they were helping. They need to be strong. There was the one figure, I think, did you start put Rosier the Riveter?
Mm-hmm.
It's that poster with the yellow background, and she's like,
she's flexing.
You could do it, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And it's very that, you know, strong woman. And I honestly, this is my favorite period personally right now.
Yeah.
Because I think it's just a very powerful part in time. But then we've got the 1950s. So
it's just always on, like, boom, like one side then the other, one side then the other, like, mm-hmm. decade by decade, pretty much. These shifts are happening so fast and super inconsistently as well.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder. It's like, why are we moving this quickly? And something must be controlling this in some way.
It's like a cycle, you know, like there's fashion trends and fashion cycles. It pretty much feels like that.
Yeah. So with the 1950s, we see, like the 1930s after the flappers, but now to the extreme, we have this time of very ample hourglass figures. So easily first person come to mind is Marilyn Monroe, which she became this massive sex symbol to this day. I think nearly everyone knows who Marilyn Monroe is. So there was no more this athletic strong look, you know, all these men, they were coming back from World War II, and they wanted someone who was a more submissive looking woman who looked like who could bear children and represent motherhood, for example.
Yeah, so also the jobs that women were working when men were away, they got just replaced by men again, and then they were kind of delegated to go back towards the domestic world because